Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Ms. Johnny Nazarian, Education Program Manager at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Thank you so much, Bella, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Care Connect Education Workshop titled Advances in the Treatment of Renal Cell Cancer. This workshop is done in partnership with the Kidney Cancer Association, and you'll be hearing more from them later on in the workshop. This activity is supported by ESI Inc. and made possible through an independent grant from Merck & Co. Inc. I really want to thank them for the support of today's program. Now to start, I just want to let you know how many people are on the call today. We have over 200 participants, primarily from the United States, from rural, urban, suburban, and frontier communities. We also have a number of international participants from Australia, Canada, the Philippines, and the United Kingdom, so it is a global call. We are delighted to have you all on this program today and that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now I'm going to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Benjamin Mann. Dr. Mann is Professor, Division of Hematology Oncology, leader of the GU Medical Oncology Program, co-leader GUCDST, Medical Director of CTO, Mays Cancer Center at UT Health San Antonio. And Dr. Mann will be discussing an overview of renal cell cancer, including diagnosing and staging, current standard of care for early stage renal cell cancer, and the treatment for metastatic renal cell cancer. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Mann.
Thank you so much. That was really kind of you to invite me to speak to this wonderful group of patients and patient advocates. It truly is. You know, I feel it's truly an honor to, you know, have a chance to speak to all of you, at least for a few brief moments, about this disease that I'm quite passionate about. I do have to apologize in advance, especially because how much I respect you all, that due to some travel issues that came up yesterday and today, I'm not going to be able to stay on for the question and answer period, which I feel greatly sad about, but it is at least wonderful to be here for a few moments with all of you. They asked me to speak about this very broad topic, too much to cover in just 8 minutes. But so let me really just try to address this whole big breadth of like diagnosis, treatment of localized disease, treatment of metastatic disease, by combining it down and distilling it down to really covering a few key principles. And then obviously there's a lot of important details that go behind these principles that each of you will need to understand for your own individual situations. But at least we can discuss a few key principles in the time that we have. So let's go through each of those and discuss a key principle in terms of 1, diagnosis, 2, treatment of localized disease, and 3, treatment of metastatic disease. A very brief So in terms of diagnosis, there's really sort of 2 key principles that I think are important. 1 is that there are multiple types of kidney cancer. So we really just describe these things anatomically, right? Do you have breast cancer? Do you have kidney cancer? Do you have whatever? But for any one of these organs, there's multiple distinct types of cancer. There's multiple types of breast cancer, there's multiple types of kidney cancer, et cetera. And each of these different specific cancer types behaves differently than its sort of similar counterpart, right? So for instance, with kidney cancer, just to name a couple, there is clear cell kidney cancer. By far, it's the most common type of kidney cancer. So that's what most of our studies are centered around. But there's papillary, there's chromophobe, there's translocation, there's a variety of molecularly defined ones, like FDH mutations, et cetera. So each of these can behave differently in terms of how fast or slow they grow, but also how well they respond or don't respond to the treatments that we currently have available. So fortunately, most of our data right now is derived from studying clear cell kidney cancer because it represents about 75% of all types of kidney cancer. But fortunately, there is an increasing momentum to study these other specific types as well so that we can better define treatments that are appropriate for those specific diseases. Right now, what we largely do, not entirely, but largely what we do is use whatever we've learned from treating clear cell kidney cancer and apply that to these other diseases with some success. But if we better understand those diseases, then we could get even better success. But that's the first key principle, is that it's helpful to know what is your specific diagnosis, what is the specific type of kidney cancer that you have, because there are some important implications of that. Are there clinical trials that are available to you because you have some specific diagnosis or not, et cetera? The other important principle is one of understanding the rest of the diagnosis. So the diagnosis is really a combination of two parts, like what's the specific disease, which we just talked about, and how extensive is that disease, right? And so in terms of extent of disease, we usually think about it in terms of, do you have localized disease? So is the cancer, as far as we can tell, is it still contained within the kidney? Or is it metastatic? Has it spread outside the kidney to other organs, like the lungs or the liver or the lymph nodes or the bones, et cetera? Localized disease, we typically treat with surgery, sometimes radiation. And the intention of those treatments is to cure the patient of their cancer, because we think all of the cancer is contained within that one spot and has not spread yet. However, that understanding about localized versus metastatic is based on scans, right? Do we see disease outside or not? And it's important to understand that our scans aren't perfect. They can see big things, they can see small things, but what they don't see is very small, like molecular-sized things. So sometimes patients have metastatic disease, but the metastases are small enough that we don't yet see them. So based on a large series of clinical trials that have been done in patients who have, a diagnosis of localized kidney cancer, it seems that surgery cures about roughly half of the patients, meaning half of the patients already have metastatic disease, we just don't yet see it, and then eventually the cancer recurs. So one big effort that's ongoing in research right now is to try and better improve our diagnostic tools using newer imaging modalities, using blood-based tests to try and assess for the presence or absence of metastases. There's a lot of work going in to try and better diagnose patients. And that's important because for those patients that are truly diagnosed with localized disease, we can try to minimize their treatment to prevent long-term consequences. So maybe just do surgery alone and no other treatment. Whereas patients that have some microscopic metastases, they may need surgery plus something else, right? The surgery to address the disease that we see in the kidney and the medicines or whatever to address the microscopic disease that we don't yet see. So there's a lot of work going on to better improve our diagnosis. At present, so now to shift to the second topic, how do we deal with or how do we treat localized disease? At present, there's really two strategies that we have. You can do surgery or radiation, or technically cryotherapy, followed by surveillance, or you can do one of those modalities followed by adjuvant treatment with pembrolizumab. It's an immune therapy-based treatment, meaning that this medicine helps stimulate your body's immune system to then go on and fight the cancer and eradicate any residual treatment. There's been a lot of controversy, in the field about what the role of adjuvant pembrolizumab is or not. I will say that it seems that the controversy is subsiding and dying down. It hasn't completely gone away, but it's subsiding and more physicians are feeling like it has a strong role as we get longer and longer follow-up from the KEYNOTE trial that led to the approval of adjuvant pembrolizumab. And it seems like it is curing more patients, at least this is my judgment or my opinion, it seems like it is curing a larger fraction of patients if we couple that with surgery than we can achieve with surgery alone. It's not a huge advancement. It seems like it's about a 10% increase of a cure rate, but it is an improvement, and so it's becoming less controversial over time. Because it's a treatment, there are some consequences of receiving that therapy. There's some side effects and toxicities. So it's a balance between, for an individual patient, is this likely going to offer enough benefit that it's worth the trade-off of the toxicities? So for localized disease, in summary, for localized disease today, we do curative intent treatment with surgery or radiation or cryotherapy, and then depending on how aggressive the disease is behaving, then we have a discussion and an individual decision with the patient about should we do adjuvant pembrolizumab. For metastatic disease, so again, this is cancer that has spread outside the kidney to involve other organs of the body. The general principle is that metastatic disease is not curable, but it's treatable. However, the treatments we have include targeted therapies, meaning in some molecularly specific way, they're damaging the cancer cells wherever they are. So we have targeted therapies, and then we have immune therapy. And again, as I mentioned with pembrolizumab, which is an immune therapy, these immune therapies activate the immune system to then go on and fight the cancer wherever it is. Targeted therapies are very reliable. They don't work 100% of the time, but they work frequently, and they work for a reasonable amount of time. Immune therapies are a little less reliable, meaning there's a reasonable number of kidney cancers that are just intrinsically, inherently resistant to them. But when they do work, they can work super well, to the point that there's a small minority of patients that it can work so well in that they can be cured of their metastatic disease, right? This is not something that we were able to do years ago, but now with the introduction of immune therapies, we can cure some patients with metastatic disease. So the prognosis for patients over my lifetime of being involved with cancer, over the past 20 years, has dramatically improved. So when I was a wee little pharmacist, I and treating patients with kidney cancer, and we had very few treatments for this disease, the average survival was much shorter than it is today. Because of the explosion of the number of therapies that we have available, the prognosis has increased by, fivefold or so. But even though we're successful enough that we can cure some patients, we definitely are still doing a lot of research to try and find better ways so that we can offer this hope of cure to far more patients than what we're currently doing. So there's a lot of interest in especially in immune therapies to try and find better ways to engage the immune system to cure more patients with this disease. But at present, I'm grateful that we have a lot of other therapies that can help us control the disease, hopefully for long enough for the patients to receive the benefit of the research that's ongoing to try and find novel approaches to treat this disease. But the present paradigm right now for metastatic disease is control the disease, and the paradigm for localized disease is trying to cure the disease. So hopefully that's sufficient principles in the limited time that we've had to at least give all of you a jumping off point when you go talk to your individual physicians.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Mann. As you had alluded to at the beginning, you did cover a lot of important information in a short amount of time. So I want to thank you so much again for such a wonderful presentation and for speaking today. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Dr. Jacob Zames. And Dr. Zames is faculty physician, Department of Medical Oncology, Beth Israel, Deaconess Medical Center, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And Dr. Zames will be discussing new treatment approaches, targeted cancer therapies, and the role of clinical trials. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Zames.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for inviting me to join. It's really an honor to have the chance to be speaking with you all today. So I've been asked to speak on new and upcoming treatment approaches for RCC with a focus on targeted therapies and how this ties into clinical research. And I think that this is a really exciting time for this field in particular. For starters, as some of you may know, within the past few years, an entirely new type of anti-cancer therapy, it's called belzutifan, was approved by the FDA for use in kidney cancer. And this approval was the culmination of over two decades of research into a pathway for cancer growth and proliferation mechanism that turns out to be really characteristic of clear cell kidney cancer, which, as you've just heard, is the most common type of kidney cancer. And over this period of time, a greater understanding gained of the scientific mechanisms underpinning this protein known as hypoxia-inducible factor, the feasibility of using that drug to target the process, and multiple clinical trials proving the effectiveness and safety of that drug. And it was actually as a result of this work that one of the leaders in all this research, Bill Kalin, was rewarded the Nobel Prize in Physiology and Medicine in 2019. And while the approval was as a later line therapy, there have already been inroads into understanding how this treatment might be used earlier, including postoperatively, potentially with the drug that you just heard about, pembrolizumab, and how it might be combined with other medications. And additionally, there are other similar drugs that are currently in development. And in the targeted therapy field, there are slightly more established, but no less important drugs that Dr. Mullen talked about, which include cabozantinib, lenvatinib, axitinib, which work by stopping kidney cancer cells from being able to acclimate the environment and make more resources available to them. So in terms of kind of more upcoming treatment approaches, there's a number of types of targeted therapies that are actively under investigation. A lot of these follow a similar pattern, which has been widely adopted and nonetheless been revolutionary in the cancer field in general, which is some class of therapeutic agents, so something that works against cancer cells, connected to a molecule that can attach to structures that are found on cancer cells, and in our instance, kidney cancer cells. And the idea is to identify structures that are predominantly found on tumor cells, but not on most healthy cells, so that when the therapeutic agent is delivered, it is mostly toxic to cancer cells, while ideally leaving non-cancer cells and tissues relatively untouched. And there have been multiple such targets that are being looked at, not only for this type of therapy, but for other indications, such as maybe improving imaging and diagnosis and other types of disease monitoring. And these have names that you may at some point hear, such as CA9, KIM1, CD70. And as far as the types of therapy, the actual molecules that do the killing, some are more classic types of chemotherapy, and these fall under a general category you may also hear called antibody-drug conjugates, or ADCs. ADCs have already revolutionized treatment in certain types of cancer, including bladder cancer, breast cancer, certain types of breast cancer. Another potential therapeutic mechanism is activation of the immune system, similar to the type of immunotherapy that you've already heard about, for instance, by engaging white blood cells to get them to more directly target cancer cells. And yet another type of therapeutic agent is known as radioligand therapy and involves connecting this targeting molecule to an isotope, basically to deliver radiation to multiple sites of cancer, even in cases where the cancer is metastatic. The most well-studied and most well-known example of these is a drug that you may have heard of, which is the brand name Pluvicto, is used in prostate cancer, but it's actively being investigated in kidney cancer as well. And moving beyond the cancer cells themselves, there are a number of new types of immunotherapy drugs, as well as new combinations of existing drugs that are being investigated based on our growing understanding of the environment that the immune cells exist in and communicate with. And I alluded to this earlier, but this work really relies on thoughtful and collaborative research. And fundamentally, we're really only going to do a better job in treating all cancer types, including kidney cancer, if we're able to identify and leverage what makes tumor cells different from normal healthy cells. So a lot of things really need to go right. We need to have a broad base of available data and other resources for basic science research. We need attentive and creative scientists and researchers who are able to identify such patterns and start thinking about proof of concept experiments that show what it might be like to actually target those symptoms and prove that it's possible. There needs to be effective communication between the scientists, clinical researchers who best understand the active challenges and the areas of unmet need in their field, and members of industry who can logistically bring forward these therapies. And then when testing these, we need committed and proven centers that can act as sites for these clinical trials. And those sites need to have dedicated support staff who are able to be attentive to the needs of participants, and regulatory staff who can make sure that everything is being conducted correctly. And most importantly of all, we really need our patients to trust that all members of that chain have their best interests at heart, both individually and as a class, especially because we're asking them to devote their time and energy and take on any risk that's inherent in clinical trials. And it's because this last step, you know, the testing of these ideas in a clinical trial, it's really fundamental to proving not only that approaches such as the ones I mentioned will work in the real world, but that they can be conducted safely. You know, every cancer drug that we described to date that's in use now is in use because, you know, not just that it was interesting in theory or because of data that we were excited about preclinically, but because it really proved itself in a clinical trial setting. And with that in mind, I think one of the ways that we as researchers ensure that trials that we're engaged in live up to this ideal is by making sure that they're designed and carried out in such a way that they answer questions that are important to patients and maximize the chance that the results really could change practice. And I think that as clinicians, we're in a great position to help guide this because our patients are telling us their needs and telling us their concerns every day. And all we really need to do is pay attention and listen to that. So on a personal level, as a start to wrap up, I think a fundamental part of working in oncology is understanding that the field is not yet where it needs to be, but being excited about what we're learning today and what it could mean for our patients tomorrow. And I think that being engaged in clinical trial work and not just seeing the brighter horizon draw closer, but actively being part of moving it towards it is one of the best parts of my job. And I really try to remember throughout that in no way do we make that trek alone as clinicians. In terms of both the outcomes of the treatments and in the work that we do to develop those treatments, we're fully in lockstep with our patients. So with that, thank you again for inviting me and giving me the chance to talk with you. I really appreciate your time and your interest.
Thank you so much, Dr. Zames, for that excellent presentation. Thank you so much again. I know that there will be questions for you during the Q&A. And our next speaker is Dr. Nesli Dizman. Dr. Dizman is Clinical Fellow, University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And Dr. Dizman will be discussing how research contributes to your treatment options and managing side effects, symptoms, discomfort, and pain. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Dizman.
Hello. Again, thanks for the invitation. And, you know, this is a huge honor to be able to talk on these crucial, important issues with our patients. I'll start with the first part of my talk, how research impacts how we treat renal cell carcinoma. So every decision we make in treating kidney cancer is based on solid data. The data usually comes from research that has been the foundation of cancer care for many years. When we go back about 25 years, the treatment options for kidney cancer were very limited. But because of research, this has changed. First came the targeted therapies in early 2000s, and then immunotherapies in 2010s, and even more recently, newer treatments as we have just discussed, they continue to expand the treatment options for kidney cancer. Right now, we combine different therapies or we order them in different ways, so we have many options to treat kidney cancer. Beyond drug development, I think research also helps us learn how to use treatments better. For example, we've learned how to better anticipate the side effects, how to manage them earlier, how to help patients stay on treatment safely. We learned when to start a treatment, when to change it, and how to adjust, all thanks to research that we have concurrently done while developing new drugs. And we continue to learn from them regularly through research. So that's exactly where the research makes a big difference. Many of the patients would know when someone approaches them for enrollment in a trial or for another research project, they are asked to submit blood samples, tissue samples, sometimes other samples. And many of the research that impact outcomes come from the assessments that we do through these samples. These samples that are, really generously given us from our patients. These studies that we do using these samples, they help us understand why one treatment works very well for one person, but may not work the same way for someone else. So beyond drug development, many of the smaller parts of the research activities we have, they actually significantly move our field towards a more personalized care. So even when a clinical trial does not immediately lead to a new drug, it still teaches us important things. Every study really it's another piece to the puzzle. And, we learn from both positive and negative studies. So any involvement in research, it helps us go one step forward against, our fight to cancer. I also wanted to emphasize that research in cancer specifically, especially clinical trials we conduct, they are held to very high standards. Our goals are very clear. Treatments must be safe. They must be effective. That's what we aspire to, and we hope that the new treatments will allow our patients live longer and, just as importantly, live better lives. That's why we always prioritize making sure that our patients are protected and very carefully monitored while in research studies every step of the way. So my specific research area is on how to use the good microbes in our guts to help improve patient care and outcomes. So I study probiotics, diet, lifestyle. These are the topics where there are too many claims. So personally, I truly appreciate all research opportunities and all of our patients volunteer for, put their time and effort to help these studies for us to scientifically test these approaches. So, one day we could give really reliable evidence-based guidance about lifestyle factors, diet, and, microbiome interventions. So when we talk about research, we're all talking about people. We are talking about patients helping other patients, and we physicians, researchers, and scientists, we're here to help navigate this connection, and we take pride in that. We are so grateful for patients and their families for their support, time, and volunteering for research, which gives us more therapies or teaches us how to use which treatment when for which patient. With that, I think I'll spend the next few minutes talking about the side effects and symptoms, because this is This is among the most important parts of treatment from both providers and patient and families' perspective. Today, we see different side effects from different kidney cancer treatments, and the first step is to understand how they develop and when to expect them and how to prevent and treat them. For example, targeted therapies, we commonly see high blood pressure, fatigue, diarrhea, sometimes, hand-foot syndrome. Many of these side effects, they are somewhat predictable. They are often related to the dosing and the schedule, and they frequently improve when we adjust the dose or hold the treatment or stop treatment. Second biggest treatment category in kidney cancer is immunotherapies. They work differently. They activate the immune system to fight cancer. So their side effects come from overactivated immune system fighting normal human healthy tissues. So because of this, any organ system could be affected with immunotherapies, and the timing of their side effects could be unpredictable, and the degree to which it would impact a patient's life, the greater the side effects could be unpredictable as well. The common ones are diarrhea, rash, liver toxicity, hormone changes, and the treatment of these side effects are mostly through using agents that suppress the immune system through different means. In the setting of immunotherapies and other treatments as well, the key is to remember that early recognition matters, because some of the symptoms may worsen if not identified early, while they could be very easily manageable if we act on them early. And the third class of the treatments that we have already discussed are the HIF-2 alpha therapies. These treatments are effective on the direct pathologic reason of kidney cancer development. And that's why they have, because of different mechanism action, they have unique side effect profiles. The more important, the most important notable ones would be drops in blood counts or drops in oxygen levels, for which we regularly monitor our patients and have treatments for. So as I mentioned, I think across all treatments, the most important principle in management of side effects from anti-cancer therapies is early communications. What we always tell our patients is, please, don't feel like you need to figure out what is causing a symptom. That should be our job. We will be happy to help with that. And if something feels new or concerning, let us know early, because being able to accompany a patient through the developmental side effects, or perhaps not even a side effect, but some other acute problem that's going to go away. So I think knowing the entire picture allows us to act on a timely manner and prevent any worsening from side effects. When it comes to the cancer-related symptoms, discomfort and pain, the core principle, I think it remains the same. Our patients do not have to manage these symptoms alone. Seeking help earlier, reporting symptoms to the oncology team, and sometimes involving specialists such as pain management, supportive care, or integrative medicine teams, this can make a big difference, regardless of the stage of the cancer. Many of the symptoms in oncology are multifactorial, meaning they can have more than one cause. Sometimes symptoms may be related to the cancer itself, sometimes to the treatment, sometimes to the things like stress, sleep disruption. This is why having a care team that listens carefully and looks at the whole picture is so important. And our goal is to really carefully listen to our patients and try to find the root cause or many different causes of one symptom, and address them in a personalized and thoughtful way. Before I conclude, I wanted to highlight symptoms that sometimes do not get enough attention. Things like poor sleep, mental health concerns, anxiety, memory issues, concentration changes, loss of appetite, muscle loss, weakness. They may not sound as harsh to ear as the other side effects that I mentioned, but they actually can have a major impact on daily life and outcomes as much as any other symptom. So they may not be visible to the patients, their families, and sometimes to most of the doctors too. It's important to bring them up because we could explore ways to manage these symptoms together, because simply they're as important as the cancer itself when it comes to overall well-being of our patients. So with that, I think I'll conclude my talk about the side effects and symptoms as well. Thank you so much for the opportunity to talk here, and I'll look forward to your questions.
Thank you so much, Dr. Desmond, for that stellar presentation. Especially toward the end, highlighting the importance of early and continued communication with the healthcare team. Thank you. Thank you so much. And our next speaker is Diana Bearden. And Ms. Bearden is an oncology dietitian at the Michael E. DeBakey VA Medical Center. And Ms. Bearden will be discussing nutrition and hydration concerns and tips. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Bearden.
I'm excited to be part of today's presentation. Nutrition and hydration are essential, not only in the tolerance to your treatment, but providing you the energy to do the things that you enjoy, your quality of life. Your diet might be modified during or even after your cancer treatment just to assist with managing side effects. Some potential side effects include things like dry mouth, changes in taste, maybe sores in your mouth, a decreased appetite, diarrhea, and maybe fatigue. Now, each person is individual, so it's so important that you talk with your healthcare team as things arise so that we can help address those issues as soon as possible. But during your course of treatment, your nutrition needs can change, and this might require a modification in your diet. So meeting with a dietitian can really help individualize your unique needs. Each person's individual, we're all unique, and we all have special health conditions that require an individualized plan of care, and so a dietitian can provide that for you. Things that the dietitian may talk about with you include your calorie, your protein, and your fluid needs, and it may even give you some information on texture changes and things along those lines just based on what your challenges are. Even if you're overweight, you can become malnourished. A lot of people have a hard time kind of understanding that, but nutrition is a lot of different things, and weight is one of the measures that we use, but there are some other measures we use as well. And when we're not getting our nutrition needs, the body doesn't have what it needs to function optimally. And so sometimes when we're not eating enough, our body may use our muscle as an energy source. And when we start losing muscle, things like increased fatigue can result, maybe a decrease in endurance. That would impact you being able to do the things that you really enjoy. And so important that we help you along the way through this journey. Now, some side effects may interfere with your eating as well, or may be interfere with the way that you feel. And so the doctors a lot of times will give you medications to help address these, and sometimes it can feel overwhelming. So always having somebody else with you is very useful, or keeping a good record of what you have and when to take it. If there's specific foods you're struggling with, take note of that. Tell a dietitian that you're challenged with this, or that this is what happens after you eat it, and they can give you feedback and helping make some modifications. Now, hydration is sometimes forgotten because we're focusing so much on foods, but dehydration is a very real issue, especially in our cancer patients. And dehydration can actually amplify some of those side effects that don't make us feel so great, such as nausea, fatigue, and even making you feel dizzy. But fluids are anything that's liquid at room temperature, so things like water, milk, juice, for example. And a general guideline is most people need between 8 and 10 8-ounce glasses of fluid a day. Now, like I said, your unique needs are really what we want to focus on when meeting with your healthcare team, but this is a general statement. But some treatments may require an increase in fluid, and some treatments might require a decrease in fluid intake. So understanding your unique plan is so very important. But I just want you to know that the dietitian is part of your healthcare team. They serve as a support member for you during this entire journey, and communicating with your healthcare team is so important. So please know how to reach them, reach out to them sooner rather than later. And on that note, I'm going to hand the line back.
Thank you so much, Ms. Bearden, for that superb presentation. You covered a lot of information, highlighting the importance of the oncology dietitian and also the multidisciplinary team. So I want to thank you so much again for speaking today. And our next speaker is Ms. Sarah Tuck. And Ms. Tuck is Senior Manager Patient Programs, Kidney Cancer Association. As I mentioned at the beginning, the Kidney Cancer Association is our collaborating organization on this workshop. So grateful to have them on today and for our continued partnership with them. And Ms. Tuck will be discussing the Kidney Cancer Association's free programs and services, as well as their support line and website. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Tuck.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me today. And just thank you to Cancer Care for the incredible work you do to support patients and families affected by cancer. I'm here representing the Kidney Cancer Association. We are an international nonprofit organization dedicated to serving and empowering people affected by kidney cancer through advocacy, research, support, and education. One of the ways we support patients is through in-person and virtual patient education events. These are often in partnership with leading cancer centers. These programs give patients and caregivers the opportunity to hear directly from kidney cancer experts, ask questions, and learn about the latest advances in treatment and care. In addition to events, we offer several practical tools and support resources on our website. These include a clinical trial finder, which helps patients explore available clinical trials, and a treatment center finder to help people locate kidney cancer specialists and centers with expertise in treating their kidney cancer. We also offer a patient navigator program, which helps individuals and families better understand a kidney cancer diagnosis, find reliable information, and identify appropriate resources as they navigate their care by contacting our patient liaison. For those looking to connect with someone who has been through a similar experience, our peer-to-peer mentor program pairs patients and caregivers with trained volunteer mentors who can provide support and share their own perspectives. We also have monthly virtual peer-led support groups dedicated to patients and caregivers. This is a great place to connect with those who are on a similar journey as you. In addition, we host a podcast that features conversations with clinicians, researchers, and most importantly, patients and advocates who share their experiences and help others stay informed and feel connected to the kidney cancer community. We have so much more to offer, but in the interest of time, if you or someone you love has been impacted by kidney cancer, we encourage you to explore these resources and learn more at the Kidney Cancer Association website at kidneycancer.org. Thank you again to Cancer Care for the opportunity to be here today.
Thank you so much, Ms. Tuck, for that comprehensive overview of all that you offer at the Kidney Cancer Association. Sounds like it's an excellent resource for our participants to look into. And I want to mention that in about a week after this program, you will get an evaluation email that will contain that all the resources that have been mentioned today on this workshop. So please do not feel as if you have to write everything down. We will send that to you in about a week to 10 days. And our next speaker is Cheryl Mullery. And Ms. Mullery is an oncology social worker here at Cancer Care. And Ms. Mullery will be discussing Cancer Care's free national programs and services, as well as our Hopeline and website. It is now my great pleasure to turn this program over to my colleague, Ms. Mullery.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be part of this wonderful program to give an overview on Cancer Care services. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization providing free professional supportive services and information to help manage emotional, practical, and financial challenges of cancer. Our comprehensive services include resource navigation, counseling and support groups, educational workshops, publications, and limited financial assistance. There are many aspects of a kidney cancer diagnosis that can be addressed through psychosocial supportive services. Making informed treatment decisions, quality of life concerns, clinical trials, and communication with one's medical team are important topics that can be discussed with an oncology social worker through individual counseling. Individuals diagnosed with kidney cancer may also choose to supplement their existing social networks by joining a support group. Cancer Care offers a national online support group, which are moderated by oncology social workers. These online support groups aim to reduce feelings of loneliness and anxiety, explore new ways of coping, increase feelings of empowerment, and provide practical information about treatment and resources. Many hospitals, treatment centers, and other nonprofit organizations offer supportive services as well. Individuals may also experience practical and financial concerns through their treatment. Please know that if you are encountering such financial hardships or concerns, there are organizations that may be able to help you. Cancer Care can assist in helping you locate resources through our resource navigation program, which offers short-term, strength-based approach to patients and caregivers affected by cancer nationally. A trained specialist will work with clients in connecting them with resources, referrals, and financial assistance. Cancer Care also offers clinical trial information through a website it developed called mytrialist.org. This resource helps people find clinical trials and offers support throughout the clinical process. If you are interested in learning more about our services, please contact our Hopeline at 1-800-813-4673 to speak with one of our oncology social workers, or you can check out our website, cancercare.org, which is full of an array of resources and information.
Great. Thank you so much, Ms. Mullery, for that wonderful overview of all that we offer here at Cancer Care. I want to thank you so much again. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A. We're going to take as many of your questions as possible. I'm going to ask Bella to explain to you how to queue up for questions.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
Thank you, Bella. And so our first question here, it's for Ms. Mullery. What advice or tips would you recommend when dealing with scanxiety?
Sure. There's a few tips and tricks you can use. First, I would suggest control what you can. Try to focus on small things that you can control, such as scheduling your scan early in the day if possible. Ask your doctor when the results are likely to arrive. Schedule a results call in advance of the results appearing in your portal. And plan something comfortable and comforting after the scan, like coffee with a friend, or watching a movie or taking a walk in nature. Also, limit your Google searches. When anxiety arises, it's tempting to search online for symptoms or scan interpretation, but this lacks the full medical context of your situation, and this can lead to catastrophic thinking. Third, use breathing and grounding exercises when anxiety arises. This will help your brain get out of the fear loop and back to the present. Schedule some worry time. This might sound a little odd, but it's surprisingly helpful. Set 10 to 15 minutes per day to write down your worries about the scan. When the worries appear outside of that time, remind yourself, I think about this during my worry time. Lastly, talk to someone who gets it. People who People often feel isolated with SCANxiety, but find helpful supports in family and friends, oncology social workers or therapists, support groups. Even brief conversations or just saying, I'm feeling anxious, waiting for the scan results, can help reduce emotional pressure. SCANxiety affects even people who have gone through many scans. Feeling anxious about your scan doesn't mean you're weak. It means you're human. It's a human response to uncertainty. I hope these tips help.
Thank you so much for that answer. And our next question is for Dr. Zames. What is the difference with saying renal cancer and kidney cancer? Can you get renal cell cancer if you had previous cancer? Are there any blood cancer markers to look for?
Sure. So broadly speaking, I would say in the majority of cases, we're talking about the same thing if we say renal cancer or kidney cancer. Renal cell carcinoma is kind of the full RCC title, and as was mentioned, most of the time we're talking about the clear cell types. There are some other subtypes. And I would say in the majority of cases, that kind of covers things. In terms of other sort of testing, so this is an area that's pretty actively being investigated. I would say that there are a lot of really great ideas about certain things that we can watch for. One of them I mentioned called KIM-1. There's a thought in a lot of different types of cancer and it's being investigated in kidney cancer as well that if we're able to get enough of the cancer cells to really look at their DNA, we can see what's different about the DNA compared to normal cells, and then we can sort of be on the lookout for that DNA elsewhere by checking for it in blood samples. I think that those are currently being investigated and not necessarily ready for use right now, but it's definitely an active area of interest for a lot of us, an active area of research.
Thank you so much, Dr. Zames. I have a question here for Dr. Desmond. What is the difference between targeted therapy and immunotherapy? Why is one used instead of the other?
Hi, great question. So they are different types of treatments. The targeted therapies are small treatments, mostly small molecules. They are mostly taken orally in a pill form, and they their mechanism is to go find a certain molecule that's on the surface on cells. So they would go find that certain molecule, which is mostly on cancers because that's how they are designed, and then they kill the cancer directly. So that's how they are targeted. And immunotherapies are immune treatments. The cancer is actually developed ways to escape the immune system in our bodies. We would use this analogy of a fake badge at times. Think about the hospital. In the hospital, I enter the hospital with my badge, and people wouldn't ask me a lot of questions because they see I have a badge. But what if there were other cells in the body that are bad with fake badges, and our immune system wasn't able to see them? So they just grow, they do their bad things, and then they become the cancer, but immune system still doesn't see them. So immunotherapies are like scanners that could identify fake badges. And when we give the immunotherapies, they would identify the fake badges and immune system goes and kills the cancer. So the mechanism is not targeted towards the cancer, but it's really boosts the immune system to help go find the cancer that's in the body. So these are the different mechanisms of actions. When and how they are used, a little bit more complicated, but it's also simple. The immune treatments are used, as Dr. Mon mentioned, in the settings in which the cancer is removed, and we know that immune therapies are effective to cure more patients if they are given after removing the cancer in early stage cancer. Immune therapies and targeted therapies that are both used in metastatic or advanced cancer. but the combination strategy or the how to sequence them is really decided based on the individual characteristics of the patients. When it comes to the side effects, the targeted therapies, the most common side effects we would see with them would be, you know, fatigue, diarrhea, sometimes damage to the liver enzymes, and hand-foot syndrome, or, you know, the mouth sores. So, in, for immune therapies, the side effects are like from immune activation. So it's a very wide range of immunotherapies that are mostly managed by, you know, early recognition, intervention, and slowing down the immune system a little bit with therapies.
Great. Thank you so much, Dr. Desmond. I am now going to ask our speakers to provide takeaways for our participants. We will start with Dr. Zames, Dr. Desmond, Ms. Tuck, and Ms. Mullery. So we'll start with Dr. Zames.
Yeah, so I think what I would really hope to highlight is that the past maybe 20 years of treatment of kidney cancer has really been revolutionized by a lot of the treatments that we've talked about. I think we are getting better all the time at figuring out what sets cancer apart and what we do about it. And while there have been a number of amazing insights that we've gained, really at the end of the day, what is most important in proving that we've gotten what we need to out of those insights to be able to help our patients is actually being able to test those ideas in a controlled setting. And so that's why I think many of us are so passionate about this kind of work, is because it really gives us the opportunity to continue along that and push that revolution to sort of the next point.
Thank you so much, Dr. Zames. And Dr. Desmond?
From the research standpoint that I covered today, first of all, I'd say thank you to our patients for really moving the field forward, for donating their time, efforts, sometimes their blood, sometimes their stool. So that's how we achieve the accomplishments, Dr. Zane, that just mentioned, that the revolution that we've seen in the past decade in the field. So the research is a way for patients to help other patients, and for us to help advance to this, how we treat this cancer. So we encourage participation in research projects. And for the side effects and standpoint, I guess, you know, just like I talked about what side effects, when, how to treat two times, but one important thing to remember is to never undermine a side effect, and always know that your team would rather hearing about a brief diarrhea episode rather than, you know, 3 days later hearing about a more serious diarrhea complication. So yeah, just don't really bother yourself to try to think if these symptoms are, like, if this diarrhea is from the beans I ate last night, or from the targeted therapy, or from the immune therapy. Just let us know. We can tackle together, you know, good communication, early intervention for the side effects and symptoms.
Thank you so much, Dr. Desmond. And Ms. Tuck?
Hi. I just wanted to reiterate that the Kidney Cancer Association is here to ensure that no one faces kidney cancer alone. We're here to help provide education, support, connection, and community. We're here at the KCA to help you make informed decisions so you can confidently navigate your care.
Thank you so much, Ms. Tuck and Ms. Mullery.
Yeah, same with cancer care. We're here to support you. You're not alone in this journey. I encourage everyone to seek out the support that they need. There's a lot of resources out there, and we're here to help.
Thank you so much, Ms. Mullery. I just want to take this moment to thank all of our speakers today. You've been phenomenal. It's been an excellent workshop today. And I also want to thank our participants. Today's program was phenomenal because of the questions that were asked and the way those questions were answered by our speakers. Now, I do want to say a few words, though, for those of you that didn't get your question answered or simply had your question answered, but we still want to encourage you to go back to your treating healthcare team and ask them your questions. Remember, you've learned a great deal from today's program, and I want you to take what you've learned and go back to your treating healthcare team and ask those questions again and again. Now, I do want to remind everybody that it's important to know who to contact on evenings, weekends, and holidays. And I also just want to echo what Ms. Tuck and Ms. Mullery said, that you are not alone. You have a community of support here at Cancer Care and also at the Kidney Cancer Association. I appreciate everyone's participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you so much.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.